Political reporters like to talk about electoral math, right? Well, today it's our turn, the economic math of American politics right now, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday today, November the 8th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. Elections, it's been said, have consequences. And last night's were no exception. The Republican losses come at an awkward time in the politics of this economy, specifically the tax overhaul plan the GOP is trying to get through Congress. And even more specifically than that, in light of the results last night, making the math work, which seems, and this is just a theory, harder today. Damian Paletta is a senior economic correspondent at The Washington Post. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
So how am I doing with this math thing? I mean, it's not a bad thesis, right?
No, I give your thesis an A+. I mean, in the House side, they have overpromised tax cuts to businesses. They've essentially promised $1.75 trillion in tax cuts, and they can only give $1.5 trillion in tax cuts. So they're $75 billion over. And they have to decide whether they're going to claw back some of those tax benefits they've promised companies. And on the Senate side, they have to focus really quickly because they cannot go over $1.5 trillion in tax cuts. You have several Republican senators who have said they will oppose any tax cut that adds to the debt. Trump wants this bill passed, you know, by Thanksgiving or possibly a week or two after, and they have to make these decisions.
Yeah, so we'll get to the deadline here in a minute, but what about the flip side of my thesis, right? Instead of the math being harder for them now, is it possible that the results of the election last night gave Republicans in Congress some idea of what it can and cannot do?
You know, we've already heard from several Republicans who are writing the tax legislation. They're having a really hard time explaining how the middle class will benefit from these tax cuts because, quite frankly, the middle class tax benefits are not, you know, very transparent and evident. And so I think particularly in the Senate, we're going to see a real focus on trying to make sure that the benefits are understood and probably even ratchet back a bit the tax benefits for companies so that they can ensure these benefits for the middle class will be long lasting. The question is, are voters going to believe them, that Americans will kind of feel better, they'll see the money heading into the midterms?
Let me get directly to the politics of this thing. The House and the Senate, they have to pass the exact same bill. Do you think that is possible given last night's election?
Yes and no. I think right now they feel like they're under tremendous pressure to get something done. They need a legislative achievement. Someone's going to have to make some tough calls here. And right now we're seeing the president, you know, really hands off on the details. But if he wants to get a deal done, he might have to intervene soon because right now there's really not a lot of overlap.
Let me ask you this, though, since you brought him up. Do you think the president has the economic capital, also I guess the political capital, right, but the economic capital after last night to convince senators and congresspeople that this is what they got to do?
Great question. There was a meeting last night on the Hill between Gary Cohn and some other White House officials with about 8 Senate Democrats. The president called in on Gary Cohn's cell phone and was on speaker. It was kind of this awkward situation where people were hovered. They couldn't really hear him because he's in Asia. And he was telling them about how, you know, this bill is not going to help the wealthy. He said he talked to his accountant about the legislation and it would hurt him. He's trying to make arguments to them that the numbers just don't support when they look at reports and statistics. And so eventually he's going to have to sort of put up some numbers to help convince them about this argument he's making. Because right now, the wealthy really will do better under this bill. And I guess the idea is that if they do better, then the money can kind of flow through the economy and everyone can get jobs. But I think the Democrats are just really skeptical of that. And some Republicans feel like, you know, that's going to be really hard for them to sell to their voters.
A quick word about deadline and then I'll let you go. It is a self-imposed thing. There's no statutory requirement. There's no nothing, right? It's just Republicans saying we got to get this done.
That's right. It's sort of a political deadline. Right. Nothing changes if they don't get it done soon. But I think as they get closer to November 2018, It gets harder and harder for them to do anything. And if they want to have tax cuts and have the impact felt in the economy, they feel like the sooner the better.
Damian Paletta at the Washington Post. Damian, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Wall Street Today. Traders kept on keeping on. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Damien and I were talking about how much the GOP tax bill is allowed to increase the debt. $1.5 trillion is the magic number they have got to stick to. But there was some not encouraging news on that front from the Congressional Budget Office today. $1.7 trillion over 10 years is what the CBO says it is going to add to the national debt, which means exactly what in real life? Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has that one.
The national debt is one of those numbers that can be pretty tough to get your mind around. It's more than $20 trillion. That's a 20 followed by 12 more numbers.
It's humongous. I've never seen so many numbers put together like that before.
Michael McCallie is 29. He works in New York City. And surprisingly, he was getting his first look at that number on a mobile phone. Surprising because for years, there was a debt clock the size of a billboard near Times Square, not far from where he was standing. But the clock came down a few months ago with little fanfare.
I'd rather not think about it. It doesn't really affect my daily life.
Republicans in Congress would probably prefer people didn't think about it either, especially since the deficit that would be created by the GOP tax plan seems to get bigger with every new estimate. And deficits, when they don't get paid back, get added to the national debt. David Primo of the Mercatus Center says it's kind of like filling a bathtub.
The water in the tub is the national debt, and the water flowing into the tub is the deficit in any given year.
It's a rare year we don't have a deficit. Sometimes it trickles in. Other times...
eventually, right, that tub is going to overflow and then you've got a real problem on your hands.
Or several problems. Growing debt can push up interest rates. That makes home loans and credit more expensive. It can also trigger inflation. Plus, paying interest on the debt can mean less money for other priorities, like infrastructure, education, or health care. There are other ways to look at this, though, says economist Stephanie Kelton at Stony Brook University.
I'll use the bathtub analogy, but I'll do it differently. And I'll say, all right, the bathtub has a little line inside the tub.
That line, she says, represents full employment. Government spending, even deficit spending, can stimulate the economy and push us closer to that line. That's the argument the Trump administration makes, that the GOP tax plan, even though it adds to the deficit, will boost the economy and create jobs. But, asks Kelton,
are the Trump tax cuts the kind of cuts that are going to go to people who, when they get the extra disposable income, they're going to spend that money into the economy? They're going to help create new demand and new employment opportunities for people.
Or will people who get a break on their taxes just hold on to the savings? Also, deficit spending doesn't just come from tax cuts. There are growing bills for the military, Social Security, and Medicare. Here's David Primo again.
So while the tax cuts themselves aren't going to break the bank of the federal budget, that tax cut, on top of all of the entitlement spending and so on, could cause a big flood.
That future taxpayers will be left to clean up, like Fiorello Riccobono, a junior at Florida State University. Riccobono uses social media to try to get her fellow students to care about the debt.
If we start worrying when we're already feeling it, it's too late.
She wants to start a business after college.
And I want to enter into a workforce where the economy is thriving, and having an unsustainable federal spending track puts that all at jeopardy.
So she wants Congress to close the tap. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We are on stop number three of President Trump's Asia trip, the economic centerpiece of his itinerary, a couple of 3 days in China. Here's another way to think of it. As Trump shook hands with President Xi in Beijing today, that was 40%, 40% of the global economy getting together right there. President Trump brought with him on the trip a whole slew of American executives, all of them angling for a piece, or perhaps one should say a bigger piece of the Chinese market. We got our China correspondent Jennifer Pak on the line from Shanghai to talk things over about this. Hi, Jennifer.
Hey, Kai.
So you and I both know that there are American companies all over China making a whole bunch of money. What are American companies looking for out of the president's trip then?
Well, it's true. American companies have been making lots of profits here in China. But the problem is, they say it's getting harder to become successful in China. Why? Because of government regulation. So American companies have been forced into joint ventures. Sometimes they've been forced to transfer their technology. Other times, their products take a very long time to be approved by the government. And last but not least, the rules are never really clear here in China. So American companies say they need some help from the Trump administration.
The president ran, as you know, on bringing jobs back to the States. What's this trip going to do for that?
Well, American businesses here say there's been a huge misunderstanding that factory jobs lost in America were lost to Chinese workers. Well, in fact, they've been lost to machines. I spoke to the Chamber of Commerce president here in Shanghai, Ken Jarrett, and here's how he explains it.
Well, in some ways, I think the hardest thing for people to understand is that the successes of U.S. companies here actually help the U.S. economy back home. Now, those jobs may not be manufacturing jobs, but they could be either marketing or product development, R&D, in fact, better paying jobs.
The other thing is that American consumers have been benefiting from this relationship between the two countries because they get to buy cheaper goods that are made in China.
Okay, so what does the president bring to the table, though? I mean, we know what he wants out of President Xi, right? He wants help with North Korea. What does the president have that he can offer?
Well, Chinese businesses have been investing heavily in American technology and also American companies. So that's possibly one way in which America can get some leverage. They can say, well, if China will not allow American companies to do something here in China, then they should not be allowed to do the same in the U.S. This is reciprocity. And analysts say this negotiation really has to happen very quickly because China has a very ambitious plan called Made in China 2025. Mm-hmm. It's really a plan to upgrade the manufacturing, and they're moving in almost every major sector of the future. They've already been very aggressive in artificial intelligence, also green technology. So American businesses here say that they need a level playing field.
Before I let you go, we've seen on TV, of course, the president in the Forbidden City and walking around with President Xi. What's it been like, say, on the streets of Shanghai today?
Honestly, here in Shanghai, I haven't really seen much, but you've got videos of President Trump and the First Lady visiting the Forbidden Palace. This is unprecedented, I suppose, for foreign dignitaries to be brought there on a state visit. And the local media calls this State Visit Plus. So President Trump and the First Lady are getting first-class treatment here. Of course, the talks that are up ahead will be very tough for both sides.
Jennifer Peck in Shanghai. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
All right, so Jennifer mentioned Chinese firms investing in American technology companies. Oh, look, here's one. We learned today that the Chinese messaging giant Tencent has bought up about 12% of Snap, parent company of the disappearing messaging app Snapchat. I should say troubled parent company because since its big IPO back in March, Snap shares have lost fully half of their value, leading to the inevitable speculation that it might be ripe for an acquisition. We asked Marketplace Jed Kim to find out what it is that Snap has that makes it actually valuable.
I don't get Snapchat. Messages that disappear? It's probably because I'm old. Or exactly because I'm old. My demographic is decidedly uncool.
Snapchat really kind of has a lock on those teenagers and young adults.
Jan Dawson is chief analyst for Jackdaw Research. He says that lock is one thing that makes Snap valuable. Snapchat's designers are geniuses at keeping that target audience engaged through innovations like streaks, which reward you for keeping conversations going day after day.
It's like dopamine. I mean, it's a dopamine rush for these kids. They kind of keep those streaks alive, and it's very addictive.
And addiction feeds ad revenue, but not enough. Dawson says Snapchat hasn't capitalized on ad sales effectively, and its young user base has begun to migrate to other platforms. Ali Mogarabi is an analyst with Morningstar. He says Snapchat's second value proposition is that it's continually innovating new addictive features. The problem is larger companies like Facebook can just copy them. And do.
They are in a very tough situation.
Tough because they'll have to keep spending a lot on research and development in order to stay the innovator. As for Tencent's major share buy, Mogarabi suspects that's about gaining an insider's view to new Snapchat products.
And possibly apply the same type of innovation to its own huge user base that it has with various apps, including WeChat.
Of course, it could also be an investment too. Snap says it's redesigning its app to bring in more users. I'm Jed Kim for Marketplace.
I don't get Snapchat either, man. I seriously don't. All right, anyway, coming up.
When I turned 18, I remember my sister saying, all right, you go to big boy jail now.
And you will probably have to find your own health insurance, too. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials up 6 today. Basically, Bupkis closed at 23,563. NASDAQ up 21, 0.3%, 6789, 6789. Look at that. S&P 500 up 3, 0.1%, 25.94. Banks, well, they kind of hit the skids today. J.P. Morgan Chase gave up 1.1%. Citigroup down about 0.5%. Bank of America off 1.4% today. Video game makers hit a winning streak. Take-Two Interactive firmed up 10.5% today, posted better than expected second quarter revenue. Other gaming software firms rose as well. Electronic Arts up 0.2%. Activision Blizzard improved 5.8% today. Bond prices went down. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.33%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There have been two big media stories burbling around this week about which an update seems prudent. First of all, there's a bit of a yes, you did, no, I didn't thing going on with AT&T's proposed $85 billion purchase of Time Warner. There are reports today the Department of Justice is going to insist AT&T sell off CNN as a condition of the deal going through, and that AT&T CEO Randall Stephenson has offered to do just that, to get things done. Stephenson said in a statement today he has offered no such thing. Thank you very much, nor would he. So there is that. Also this week, reports by CNBC that the Murdoch family has been talking to Disney about selling it a big chunk of 21st Century Fox, the entertainment parts of it, to be specific. Sarah Ellison wrote about the rumored deal and the complicated Murdoch family dynamics that it presents in Vanity Fair. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I think it's interesting that the Murdoch boys have decided to hold on to arguably the most troublesome part of their dad's empire, Fox News, right?
Well, right. It's certainly the part that James feels not particularly connected to. It's the part of the company that has given them a lot of trouble recently. But I think they're sort of going for what's pragmatic. Assuming that these deal talks are real, right, assuming that they happen, one possible reason that they would want to do can complete a deal that's like this is to separate Fox News, which has become increasingly controversial, from Sky, which is, people that I've talked to talk about Sky as a cash register, and it's a deal that they have wanted to complete for a long time.
Right. Sky, of course, is the sort of, it would be a sort of a global sort of platform for the Murdochs.
Right. So Sky is something they own part of, and they have owned a part of it for a while, and it's a pay television satellite service, and it's the distribution part of what everyone in the media needs. Disney, on their side, is interested in distribution. They cut off their relationship with Netflix and bought a platform for distribution of their own. It's the kind of deal that marries a great distribution platform with what Disney has, which is great content. And that's sort of one of the big motivating factors in all of media these days is to have both sides of that equation.
You also point out in this piece that the Murdochs have known for a while, and this sort of struck me because 21st Century Fox is a ginormous company. The company's always been too small to compete at scale globally.
Well, that's increasingly the case. So, you know, a few years back, 21st Century Fox tried to by Time Warner, and they were rebuffed and withdrew the offer pretty quickly. Meanwhile, you have NBC Universal being bought by Comcast. So increasingly, as big as 21st Century Fox is, it's not quite big enough. And that's something that, you know, James Murdoch in particular has talked about a lot. And I think that, you know, one of the ways it might actually survive is to split it apart.
Again, assuming that these talks were, first of all, real, but second of all, wind up going anywhere, what do you suppose the conversation was like at the breakfast table in the Murdoch household when James McLaughlin said, hey, Pop, we got this idea?
Well, there is something. I mean, what's fascinating about this family is that it, and this is a cliche, but there is something Shakespearean about it, where they have spent their entire lives, the sons, trying to please their father, but at the same time, they have ideas of their own, and they have friends of their own. And I think that Rupert Murdoch has been kind of proudly counterintuitive in a lot of different ways, and he's enjoyed disrupting the establishment. And it's where you see James and Lachlan have to try to balance this duality of their existence, and it's quite interesting. So the breakfast table conversation is always interesting in that house, I'm sure. But on these days, it must be particularly interesting.
Sarah Ellison at Vanity Fair, writing most recently about the Murdochs and rumors of a deal between 21st Century Fox and Disney. Sarah, thanks very much.
Thank you.
We're a week into the open enrollment period for the Affordable Care Act, and despite the best efforts of the Trump administration, signups do seem to be pretty healthy. The Washington Post reports 200,000 people chose health plans on the first day that they could. That's twice as many people as signed up on day one last year. Some of those folks were probably first-time buyers, the nearly 5 million Americans who turned 26 this year and so will be getting booted off their parents' plans. But buying health insurance now is not what it was a year ago, as Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports from the Health Desk at WHYY.
On his 25th birthday, Carl Glenn kind of knew the party was almost over.
When I turned 18, I remember my sister saying, all right, you go to big boy jail now. And it's, you know, that kind of idea of, well, in a year, you better make sure you're eating your fruits and veggies and taking care of yourself, because it's a real thing now.
Coming of age under Obamacare, Glenn made some assumptions. He'd hit 26, he'd shop online for insurance, and he'd join 10 million other Americans who get their care just like that. Then Republicans won control of Congress and Donald Trump won the election. Here's the president speaking to Congress in February.
Tonight, I am also calling on this Congress to repeal and replace Obamacare.
Glenn, who was getting by off two part-time jobs, took this seriously. The threat Obamacare could be repealed scared him enough, he actually met with a health insurance guide, known as a navigator, to check out his options.
And I was like, do I need to sign up now? You know, like, my birthday's in September. Is it still going to be around by then? And he was saying, you know, I can't really tell you. I don't know.
Before this Obamacare open enrollment period, the biggest problem for young adults had been the daunting task of shopping for insurance. The jargon alone, deductibles, premiums, narrow networks, can chase off the most earnest young consumers. 25-year-old Kelly Weaver, a New York paralegal and Glenn's girlfriend, says right now people her age have to deal with those headaches and the prospect Obamacare may go away.
I have this conversation with a few people being like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to continue to get health care because I can't afford it if we lose Obamacare, if we lose the Affordable Care Act.
That's because of the ACA subsidies. Without that financial assistance, coverage is unaffordable for many, which Glenn realized after he talked to that navigator.
If we just want to do some like basic math with it, if I didn't have the tax credit that I was provided through Obamacare, plans I think are like $400-ish dollars.
Between those two jobs, working as a waiter and assisting a casting director, $400 is about a week's pay. He couldn't do that. But like lots of young adults, Glenn wanted insurance. So he considered all of his options, like getting insurance at work.
The restaurant that I work for, if you work there full time, you can get health care, which is really great. But working full time as a server is really hard. You're working 5 days a week, on your feet the whole time, having people yell at you for putting cheese on their food.
Glenn graduated with a degree in theater. That's the career he wants, maybe in casting. He's not sure yet. But it was important enough that Glenn decided to take a gamble, stick it out on his parents' plan, and hope Obamacare was still around by the time he turned 26. It was. So Glenn enrolled.
Luckily, they have not been able to repeal the Affordable Care Act, and so right now I'm okay. $200 a month is a good chunk, but it's something I can do.
Glenn's policy takes him through the end of this year. As the enrollment season opens for 2018, he's got a few weeks to decide if he'll sign up, because he's also applied for a couple of other jobs, some that offer coverage. Getting one of those would mean Glenn could worry about something other than the future of Obamacare. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Lin-Manuel Miranda does his bit for Puerto Rico. The creator and originator of the title role in Hamilton announced today he is coming back to the show for a two-week run in Puerto Rico in January. His parents, you should know, left the island for New York decades ago. Miranda said in a statement, quote, he wants to show Puerto Rico will recover and be back in business stronger than ever. End of quote. I think that's pretty cool. All right, we're off. The Dow basically flat today. NASDAQ up 21.3%. S&P 500 up 3, about a 10%. Sarah Brugger, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostat, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.